but not Hakima Khatun. So at least there is a possibility to remove this contradiction between the two. And of course, we said that none of these narrations at the end of the day are authentic, but still we have find a way to remove this apparent and semi-contradiction between the narrations.
Very true. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, for your explanations on this doubt and misconception on the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the stories around it and the doubts around the starting of the minor occultation and his ghibba, the starting point of his minor ghibba or occultation. It was explained in depth, and I think it was quite informative for those who are interested to learn about the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the doubts that goes to target this important event, that none of them have a strong base to be defended. So Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was witnessed and was seen by many people, including Lady Hakim Khatun and other companions, whether continuously or periodically. This is not something that actually matters in this issue. Dear brothers and sisters, thanks again for staying tuned and listening to The Last Savior from Arab English Radio. We shall come to you with another doubt and its answer and analysis in our upcoming session. Join us then. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjaj bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
The question of who rules America has been debated throughout America's own history. It was originally raised and answered to some degree by the American Revolution in the 1770s that fought for independence from the British Crown so that Americans, at least some Americans, could rule themselves, or at least they hoped they could.
We're at Columbia University with Dr. Eric Foner, a historian and writer and teacher here at the university for a long, long period of time.
I think what is unusual today is two things. One, the degree of inequality. Never before has the very, very top, the 1%, had so much of the national income and wealth in its own hands. And, so that the gap is greater than ever before. And secondly, Occupy Wall Street is not primarily a movement of farmers, of laborers. It doesn't have the same base. People need to learn history. That's part of our job, to know that this issue has been around for a long time. There is nothing un-American about raising the question of economic plutocracy, economic inequality. It's as American as apple pie. And, I think that the Occupy Wall Street people are, legitimate heirs of a long and venerable tradition in this country. Many revolutions start at the top. In other words, the people who began the struggle against Great Britain were merchants in Boston and New York, plantation owners in Virginia. Most of the founders in Virginia are slave owners. But what happens is, as the struggle intensifies, they have to generate support among ordinary people. And when you do that, you break open the political system and you open the door for very, very different kinds of demands. Slaves start demanding their own freedom. Women, Native Americans, start demanding greater equality. So what happens at the beginning when a more privileged class begins the resistance, that doesn't necessarily tell you how the whole process is going to take place.
This conflict between the 1%, actually the 0.001%, and the 99% had its echoes here in the home of America's anti-colonial uprising, in the back streets of Boston, where a freedom trail today commemorates a massacre by the British and a fight for liberty. And that's where we'll take you next. Was the American Revolution really a revolution?
The British thought it was a revolution, no question about that. It was not a social upheaval in the way, let us say, the French Revolution was, but it certainly overthrew an entire system of government. It replaced the ruling class with another one, so that seems to be what a revolution is about. And it raised these questions of equality in the society, not just equality in terms of 1% and 99%, but the role of slavery in American life, the status of women in American life. It unleashed a kind of struggle for equality among all sorts of groups, which continued long after the revolution was over.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. That's one of the most famous poems of the American Revolution. And here we are in front of the statue of Paul Revere, the man who alerted all of Massachusetts to the British troops coming into their communities. We're on the Freedom Trail in Boston, where the American Revolution is remembered. Well, what kind of a revolution was it? What actually happened here in Boston back in the 1700s? What have we learned since then?
Thousands of tourists and students visit these revolutionary monuments every day, but most have only a foggy idea of what really happened and tend to repeat the mythologies that are taught in their schools.
Here was Paul Revere. Paul Revere was one of the great revolutionary heroes. Are you kids here to see the statue of Paul Revere?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question about it?
Sure.
We're
sure.
Doing a little TV program here.
Yeah.
Who was Paul Revere? What was this all about? Do you know?
He was a founding father. Midnight ride. To warn about the British for coming.
Did you know that he was a very rich businessman, a silversmith here in Boston, and that he wanted to be in the Continental Army and they wouldn't let him in? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Did you know that in Boston there was this merchant class, you know, business leaders, the 1%, who were really running the whole show? In many ways, and that the people were not as involved, because back then there were slaves, there were indentured servants, there were a lot of people who didn't have a say in what was going on. Did you know about that?
No idea. I didn't know anything about Paul Revere.
We would love to learn
about the revolution.
I'm supposed to learn about it in history, but I don't think so.
My brother Bill here has taught history to students in Massachusetts for many, many, many years, and has followed, you know, the various debates about our history. What was it about this revolution? Was it a popular uprising, or was it sort of led by elites here in Boston?
Well, both were true. There were popular elements. Ordinary people did resent the British. Ordinary people did participate in riots and boycotts. But there was a 1% back then. The leaders of the revolution both led it and channeled. They were certainly not above using words like liberty and freedom to deflect and distract people from their own discontents in the colonies.
And their own interests. I mean, the business class of Boston didn't want more taxes on their products. They wanted to compete with the British goods. They felt they shouldn't be taxed. And as a result, there was the original Tea Party here in Boston.
And there were, merchants like John Hancock, who was into smuggling goods. And you're right, they didn't want to pay British taxes. I mean, there were other factors behind the revolution as well. But when this revolution was codified in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, the people who were invited were the large landowners, the slave owners, the merchant class, no women, no Indians, no blacks, no working people.
Actually, there were slaves that were inspired by the revolution to try to get their freedom. Some actually did.
I think the idea of the revolution and the idea of democracy were radical, inspiring, revolutionary, in ways that actually might have made the leaders uncomfortable, since some of them themselves owned slaves. They really didn't want this to go viral in the way it did around the world.
So who ruled America then? Mm-hmm. In a way, their grandchildren are ruling it today.
And sometimes direct descendants of those people. So, there was a certain amount of class mobility. Indentured servitude disintegrated due to the chaos of the revolution. But I don't think the people who led the revolution really intended a social revolution. That was really not what they were thinking about. After the revolution, people like Daniel Shays in Western Massachusetts, a farmer, a captain in the revolution, did try to inspire, organize another rebellion against those who he saw as replacing his British masters. This time, they were the colonial leaders.
So here we are, 225 years after the Shays Rebellion rocked Western Massachusetts, in a challenge to the 1% of those times. We have a memorial for Daniel Shays and the men who fought with him. And what's interesting is we have American flags being put, in a sense, almost at his tombstone here, marking support for the values and the aspirations that he fought for.
My name is Dave Rothstein. We are at the Stagecoach Tavern in Western Massachusetts, town of Sheffield. And this painting is a painting of Daniel Shays' militiamen. Daniel Shays fought in the revolution. They came back from the revolution and found their farms being foreclosed and many put in prison because of the same debt crisis that we're experiencing now. There are many similarities, but essentially, one of the promises of the revolution was to annul the foreign debt. And the farmers came home and discovered the debt was even greater and the banks were even tougher.
Today, the Shays Rebellion is mostly forgotten, but it lives on YouTube with songs and dramatic recreations.
Shays now unsheathed his sword and ordered the fife and drum players to strike up a tune. The men began marching in cadence.
The irony, says historian Eric Foner, is that Shays was just a front man for a mass movement.
In fact, it was the opponents who said it's Shays' rebellion in order to find a kind of boogeyman, you know, they could attack. So let's forget about Shays as a person and think about the mass movement, the farmers, the ordinary laborers who took to the streets, shut down the courts, and said, wait a minute, we had a revolution. We have installed a government that's supposed to represent the people here in Massachusetts, and yet it's the bankers and the landowners and the merchants who are getting the benefit of everything.
It was the first Occupy Wall Street movement. They petitioned the government in Boston for redress, and the government ignored the petitions. And they're having still had their arms, they went to these court sites and picketed to prevent the courts from sitting. Succeeded to some extent, until private militias were formed and the Massachusetts militias were formed to suppress it.
It was suppressed right near here, right?
The last battle was fought in Sheffield. It was led by Brigadier Ashley, the Ashley House is still here. And Colonel Ashley, his parents, were one of the heroes of the revolution. So here we have the same family building independence, but then trying to suppress it.
If many white Americans were disappointed by the achievements of the American Revolution, what about blacks and Native Americans?
In 1730, when Sheffield was incorporated, there were 30 black families in Sheffield. Half were slaves, half were free. But the famous story is, again, at the Ashley House, one of the servants, Elizabeth Freeman, called Ma Betts, overheard all the talk about the Massachusetts Declaration of Independence at the dining table. And it occurred to her that maybe she might qualify. and she actually filed in the court of Great Barrington and won her freedom. So here you have the court giving freedom on one hand and suppressing freedom on the other.
Years later, a small black community in the area that Daniel Shea has made famous became the home of a young man who had become a leader of the fight for civil rights. He coupled concerns for racial equality with demands for economic justice. Today, in the center of his hometown of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, there's a wall mural celebrating his political and intellectual contributions. It includes quotes from President Barack Obama and Martin Luther King. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois.
Du Bois was one of the giants of the 20th century, although, of course, he's born in the 19th century. Du Bois put forward the issues which are still with us, the race issue in America. You know, he said, 1903, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. It's still a problem in this country and around the world. Du Bois talked about economic equality and how to gain that, and he grappled with these questions. He's a brilliant writer, a brilliant thinker, and much of what he said is still relevant, I think, to thinking about American society.
What about Native Americans?
They were the ones to be eliminated because it was their land that was wanted, not even their labor.
Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is part of America's indigenous movements and says the people we call Indians were being exterminated. We asked her about the American Revolution.
It wasn't a revolution. It was a war of independence from the colonial overpower. But it wasn't an anti-colonial revolution like the Bolivarian revolutions in South America or the Haitian Revolution.
So there are many different, even competing narratives about the origins of the United States.
The United States, of course, was founded as a settler state, as a colonial state, became an imperialist power. And the democracy has always been an oligarchic democracy, a capitalist democracy with a rhetoric of populism, which is so strongly based on race. That is, if you're not black, if you're not a slave, you're not indigenous. If you're white and a settler, then everyone can be a king, everyone can own land and be a landlord. So all these peasants who came as settlers, the dream is to be, be the king of the hill. And so it's a very insidious kind of democracy because it's an illusion.
Illusion or not, this is a subject that needs to be examined if we are to understand who rules America, the origins of the 1%, and then teach about it.
So this is all part of the history that most Americans probably don't know. Did you find when you were teaching students here that many of them just didn't know much about their own history?
I think there are many students that I taught in one of the towns that fought at Concord who were never even in the spot we're standing in now. I think that that's true, that many kids were not familiar with that history, beyond local battlefields and so.
The other thing about the Revolutionary War, which is relevant to today because we live in a globalized world, is that this revolution started locally here in Boston, but soon the British were involved, the Dutch, the French. Mm-hmm. It became a war of many different countries all fighting on American soil.
Well, very true. And the French intervention was very critical to our success. It wasn't all through the force and valor of our arms. There were other people involved. But I think the idea itself has played a revolutionary role in history. But the idea itself did not create a deep social revolution in the United States. And to this day, people are distracted by words like liberty and freedom and justice in the same way that they were back then.
Ironically, the original Tea Party, which inspired the modern right-wing Tea Party movement today, was actually a protest against an earlier form of corporate imperialism.
Why was tea the issue, not corn or whiskey or something like that? It was because the East India Company had gone bankrupt in China, and the Crown, the British Crown, bailed them out so they wouldn't, lose their assets. But then the Crown looked around and said, well, what does the company have that we can sell? Well, it turned out what they had was tea. So they decided to market the tea. And that's why it was tea that was the taxed issue. So here you have a big financial failure, and it was global. The implications rippled across the Pacific, rippled across the Atlantic, and we have the Boston Tea Party.
Throughout our history, there have been sort of conspiracy theories about all of this. I mean, today, for example, both the right and the left seems to see the Federal Reserve Bank as sort of a conspiracy concocted in 1913 without any proper process and kind of running the show.
Yeah, well, you know, conspiracy theories, conspiracy thinking is deeply embedded in our political culture. My PhD supervisor, my mentor, Richard Hofstadter, wrote the famous book in the 1960s, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, in which he traced out various kinds of conspiratorial thinking, whether it was Catholics who were in the before the Civil War trying to undermine America, or, you know, various other groups at various times, immigrants, others trying to, you know, destroy the American culture, or the Trilateral Commission, remember them in the 1970s, was supposedly ruling the whole world. Now the Federal Reserve, right, if we only abolished the Federal Reserve Bank, everything would go back to some utopia of the past.
Throughout U.S. history, you see various right-wing movements point out scapegoats in the society, and they're usually the folks who are already marginalized in some way or another. And what happens is that there comes a moment when it becomes really useful for the elite powers, whether they're in government or corporations, to encourage these movements. So you get a Tea Party, or you get a militia movement like in the 90s, or you get the Ku Klux Klan in the 1800s. And what this is all about is taking angry, mostly white people who are mostly somewhat privileged and convincing them that they're about to fall down the social economic ladder.
Now, I guess the basic problem with conspiracy theories is that no group can fully determine what happens. Even people with great power launch things, and then they kind of lose control of them, and things happen in a way that is unpredictable.
When you look back at history, and you maybe can see, because of, you know, it's a long time ago, all of these forces. Mm-hmm. Yet today, somehow, in the news, we never see these forces. What we see are politicians spouting various, you know, rhetoric and speeches, but we don't really know whose interests they're serving, who's behind the scenes.
Well, this is why we need research. We need an understanding of who rules America. Because the mythology today is that it is the people who rule America. And most folks don't know a great deal in terms of specifics about the role that corporations play, the way politicians are tied to corporate interests.
Change is possible. I think when one talks about who rules America and a power elite, one should not use that to simply fall into a kind of quietism and say, well, nothing is possible, no change is possible, everything's under control. Many of the major popular movements in our history have been big surprises. You know, nobody expected them to come. And I think the same thing with Occupy Wall Street. Nobody expected Occupy Wall Street to come up simply out of nowhere. And so I think, we have seen that over and over again in our history, and we will continue to.
And now the ball of history has been passed to a new generation, fighting to transform a large and complex country with many power centers. But just as in the past, it is determined minorities who make the difference. An elite made the American Revolution, and as we will see, a power elite still rules. Coming up in the next episode of Who Rules America, how the military and the corporations took over.
The people who rule America are the large corporate entities, which are supranational. They have no loyalty to the nation state.
Next time on Who Rules America.
Iranian Radio. global mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. China is attempting its most complex and ambitious space mission to date with the launch of its Chang'e 5 spacecraft, which will attempt to do something that has not been done since the 1970s, bring pristine pieces of moon back to Earth. Stay with us for an article penned by Andrew Jones, a commentator and writer, under the heading China's new moon mission to return the first lunar samples since 1976. Stay with us for more of Andrew Jones's article. On 23rd of November, a Long March 5 rocket lifted off from Wenchang Satellite Launch Center on the coast of China's Hainan Island, carrying the 8.2-ton spacecraft into space. After separating from the rocket, Chang'e 5 uses its own thrusters to make the estimated 4-day trip to the moon. The spacecraft then releases a lander that touches down near a volcanic mound called Mons Rumka, in the northwest region of the lunar near side. There, it drills and scoops samples from the surface and stores them in a protective capsule. An ascent module on the lander will then launch the capsule back into orbit around the moon, hopefully carrying around 4.5 pounds of lunar material. Finally, the orbiting spacecraft will collect the capsule and return it to Earth, sending it on a high-speed re-entry to land in Mongolia at the end of the roughly 23-day-long mission. The returned lunar samples will absolutely add knowledge of the history of the moon, says Long Xiao, a planetary scientist at the China University of Geosciences. Of particular interest is the moon's volcanic activity, which scientists once thought lasted for a little more than a billion years, following the moon's formation 4.5 billion years ago. Now, scientists studying centers on the moon believe magma continued to erupt and flow in some regions of the moon until much more recently, erasing signs of some ancient craters and leaving behind younger volcanic rocks on moon's surface. The rocks sent back by Chang'e 5 will ask us to rethink about why and how the moon's volcanic history lasted this long, Long Xiao says. First approved in 2004, Chang'e 5 is a long-anticipated chapter in China's lunar exploration plans. The Long March 5 rocket, designed with this mission in mind, required numerous breakthroughs in rocket technology, built with China's most powerful engines and a new structural design. The heavy-lift vehicle failed during its second launch in July of 2017 due to an issue with one of the engine's turbopumps delaying Chang'e 5 by 3 years. Now that the mission is finally on its way, China is making a bold step in the new global era of lunar exploration. John Longsden, a space historian and professor emeritus at George Washington University's Space Policy Institute, says, "It seems like the spacefaring countries of the world now view the moon as a place for long-term exploration and potentially exploitation and even settlement." The last sample returned from the moon was delivered by the Soviet Union's Luna 24 spacecraft way back in 1976. That mission sent back 170 grams of lunar material directly from the moon's surface to Earth. Chang'e 5, however, will resemble the more complex Apollo missions, which collected 382 kilograms of material in all, involving a rendezvous and docking maneuver in lunar orbit. However, the Apollo samples are all more than 3 billion years old. Chang'e 5 aims to collect samples that are less than 2 billion years old, Long Xiao says, so scientists will be able to study the late-stage volcanism that shaped the younger parts of the rocky surface of the moon we see today. Mons Rümke, near which Chang'e 5 lands, rises about 3,600 feet above the moon's Oceanus Procellarum, Latin for Ocean of Storms. Oceanus Procellarum is a plain of volcanic rock that formed from past magmatic activity, making up the largest of the dark basaltic plains, known as maria or seas, that are visible on the surface of the moon with the naked eye. Some of the rock in this region is thought to be much younger than all the other lunar samples. The moon's volcanic history is not the only mystery that Chang'e 5 will attempt to solve, however. The landing area allows for all kinds of fundamental hypotheses to be tested, says James Head III, a planetary scientist at Brown University. Looking at the mineralogy of the rocks and soil near Mons Rümke could help reveal why the region has an unusual and unexplained concentration of certain elements. Elements such as potassium, rare earth elements, and phosphorus, and a strong radioactive anomaly driven by the elements thorium and uranium. Head says, there are really good fundamental questions to be answered that will change our thinking about the moon big time. The mission could also help calibrate timescales across the entire solar system. Counting the size and number of craters in an area gives clues about the age of the site, because impact craters accumulate at an estimated rate over time. Dating lunar samples can provide more accurate ages, not only for the moon's surface, but also for other pockmarked objects across the solar system, which are often dated by comparing their surfaces to similarly aged regions on the moon. Chang'e 5 will sample material in two ways on Moon's surface. A drill will bore to a depth of around 6 feet, while a scoop will collect rocks and lunar soil from the surface. Once on Earth, the precious cargo will be transferred in a sealed container to the Chinese Lunar Sample Laboratory located in Beijing's National Astronomical Observatory. Scientists at the facility will study the mineralogical and chemical makeup of the samples, including measuring the abundance of certain radioisotopes, elements that decay over time, to precisely date the samples. Long Xiao says the mission is a huge event for the lunar and planetary science community in China. He says, "We will have new and our own lunar samples to study, and it will inspire young students and scientists to engage in planetary science and planetary exploration." The lander will also carry science instruments similar to those on the ongoing Chang'e 4 mission, the first in history to land on the far side of the moon. A lunar penetrating radar will allow scientists to discern disparate layers of rock down to a depth of hundreds of meters, revealing the local geological history. And an imaging spectrometer, like the one used by Chang'e 4 to detect rocks that may have come from the deep lunar mantle, will be used to analyze the composition of the landing site and search for water-containing minerals. China's approach to collecting lunar samples suggests the country is looking to develop technologies that will be needed for even more missions to the moon. After the success of the lunar orbiter Chang'e 1 and Chang'e 2, and the landers and rovers of Chang'e 3 and Chang'e 4, China has laid out plans for further exploration targeting the south pole of the moon. If Chang'e 5 successfully completes its mission, an identical spacecraft called Chang'e 6 will then attempt a sample return mission from the moon's south pole, an area of intense scientific interest given the large amount of water ice and the presence of one of the largest impact craters in the solar system, the South Pole Aitken Basin. The more advanced Chang'e 7 and Chang'e 8 spacecraft are also slated to land near the south pole of the moon to carry out analysis of the region and test new technologies, including detecting and extracting materials that could be useful to future human exploration of the moon, such as water and hydrogen, and testing 3D printing on the lunar surface. The long-term aim is to establish an international lunar research station around 2030 to support robotic and eventually crewed missions to the moon.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La la la.
we're going to talk about some of the laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about Islamic laws, about different issues of miscellaneous nature. In the Western countries, you know, almost there are no swimming pools which are not mixed.
Yes.
You can't find a swimming pool, basically, which is, in fact, restricted to one gender, right?
Yes.
And there is always this fear that if you go to one of these swimming pools to swim, you're going to be seen by the opposite gender. On the other hand, we know that there are some people, medically speaking, that are in need of the water because the doctors, in fact, recommend to them to go to the swimming pool, for example, for their backache or their sore knees, you know. They need to walk in the water, all right, and yes. They don't have this facility at home.
Yeah,
it's a swimming pool. For God's sake, right? It's pretty expensive, in fact, to fix yourself one at home, you know. So you have to go outside to a gym or somewhere, you know, where this is provided to the general public. Is it permissible for the Muslims to go to such places, in fact, to go for a swim?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa is very clear and very forthright in regard to a mixed swimming pool with men and women swimming together. Ayatollah Sistani says that it's absolutely forbidden for men to swim in such a, or for women to swim in such places. Of course, it's not permissible for a Muslim to enter in a bisexual gym or a bisexual swimming pool, or even it's not permissible for a man or a Muslim man or a Muslim woman to go to beaches, no matter what the excuse. You might have chronic pain in your knees, you might have disc herniation, you might have backache, which need kind of treatment, you see. And but these excuses or these reasons cannot justify going into such places, because women in such places do not do not observe hijab, you see, they wear thin and see-through clothes. They are partially naked, and of course they are partially naked. So even if let's say if a woman is wearing full hijab and the swimsuit that she wears is covers all parts of her body,
mm-hmm.
it's not permissible for such a woman to go to such a swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sheikh Javid, we all know that waxing in many countries is pretty common.
Yes.
All right. And there are these places which are called beauty parlors or beauty saloons that provide such services.
You are right.
Is it permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani, for a woman to get her private part waxed?
That's, as you rightly mentioned, unfortunately, in some even Muslim countries, there are, see, such facilities for women. The Muslim women go to such places, and of course they uncover their private parts and get waxed. The response given by the religious authorities is clear. It's absolutely forbidden for a woman to uncover her private part and get waxed by another woman. And of course, the reason is clear. It's essential. It is obligatory for a woman to cover her private parts and prevent anyone from touching it, let alone waxing it, getting herself waxed. That's absolutely forbidden. And there are people, Muslims, who think that it's permissible and it's okay to provide such facilities. But even if there's such beauty parlor providing such services, it's not permissible. The salary, the income that is generated, is not halal either.
Mm. So running a beauty saloon or beauty parlor is not permissible, especially for a woman to have such a saloon, for example, that makes up women. So is the salary haram?
No, there should be a difference between running a beauty parlor, okay, and providing services such as the one I mentioned. You see, waxing is forbidden. Okay,
yes.
It's necessary for a woman to remove the hair around the genital area by herself.
Right.
Okay, but okay, a beauty parlor can be used for other purposes. Okay, for makeup, for adornments, for beautification, you see.
So the other services are not.
Yeah, other services included. Are not haram.
Mm.
Okay, wearing makeup in public is forbidden according to Islamic Sharia. Okay, but it has nothing to do with a woman who provides such services. Okay, she makes up women, she provides this service, but she's not telling the woman to go out wearing the makeup. Okay, she can cover herself and go to a wedding ceremony. She can drive her car and cover herself and not walk in the street in public places. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So as far as providing this service, wearing makeup and all, there are different things. You see,
mm-hmm.
The names are so many that you as a normal person, as a laity, for example, do not seem to understand what they are about. Only a hairdresser or a woman specialist knows what they actually are.
I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What about a Muslim barber? Can a Muslim barber shave the beard of another Muslim man?
Well, it is not permissible, you see. It is not permissible for a Muslim man to shave the beard of another Muslim man, okay?
Shaving the beard is haram, isn't it?
Shaving is haram as an obligatory precaution, because as far as I know, all the religious authorities have exercised precaution when it comes to beard, okay? Shaving beard is not permissible, and it's necessary to keep beard. Even though the beard might be small in size, as long as it's called beard in common view, it is permissible and it's necessary, okay?
Would you shed more light on this? Because when you say shave or shaving the beard, you mean that you either use a special shaving machine or a razor.
Razor, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you cut it like from the bottom.
Yes.
And you don't see any kind of hair on the face anymore,
yes,
right?
Is, yeah.
That's what you mean by beard shaving, okay?
Yeah, that's what we mean by shave.
Or
okay?
A shave off.
If you trim your beard and you cut your beard short, it is not haram, okay? As long as it is in the eye of custom considered to be beard, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If someone describes you as someone who has a beard, okay? Even though the beard is very short, okay, inside.
What we call a stubble.
Yeah. If in common sense, if in the eye of Urf, you are considered to be someone having beard, that's sufficient. Yes. But to clean shave, it is forbidden. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And of course, as I mentioned, as I said, according to all religious authorities, shaving is not permissible as an obligatory precaution. And this is not a fatwa, this is just a precaution.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim, Mannan Kareem, Salam Alim, La ilaha illa hum, Ghaffar Jameel, Wahhab Latif, Tawwab Samim,
of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.